Welcome to The Atypical Leader with Rick Brennan, where we talk about harnessing what makes you unique
and maybe even a little odd,
while at the same time dismantling the notion that you have to be a certain type of person or act a certain way to be an effective leader.
Definitely a leader, not a follower.
I like the sound of this.
It's time for us atypical leaders to come out of the shadows and learn to be proud and confident in what makes us different.
I'm proud of who I am.
I'm proud of who I am.
Atypical Leader starts now.
You're good, Judy?
I'm very good. Thank you very much. How are you, sir?
I'm not too bad. Well, our technical difficulties are like a little...
Oh, my God.
You know, they're like, fuck. It's like, Jesus, how many times do we got to do this and we still can't goddamn do it right? It's like, holy Jesus.
I wanted to grab the phone off and let me try it.
Yeah, yeah. Send it to my email, he's saying. Send it to my email.
Yeah. Honest to God, John, we go through this all the time. Oh, my God.
I know.
It's crazy.
Yeah, frickin' frack is probably Dumb and Dumber. Now, I don't know who's dumb and who's dumber. I'm not saying. I'll even accept the dumber.
You are the author.
Yeah, well, your technology leaves a bit to be desired.
Technology abilities? Yes, I would agree with that. Anyways, I did my interview, my video podcast with Claire Kumar yesterday.
Oh, good.
Yeah, and that went very well. Yeah, she's very nice.
Very nice, yeah. She's going to be on ours soon.
Yes, later in the year. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Yeah. We've just got to come up with a title and a thing we're going to talk about. I know we talked a lot about leadership and, you know, productivity and the people that she deals with, which are neurodiverse and more in from the sensitive point of view. So,
what are we talking about today, sir?
Well, let me give you some background. I was talking with John. Okay. I guess a year ago, I guess, when the book was coming out and all that sort of stuff, and John was very interested, and John's gone on to read the book, and since John's come back here to Costa Rica, we've had the opportunity to talk, and John said, you know, I read the book, and I was blown away with how certain things in your life matched exactly things in my life. Your experiences, in many cases, were exactly the experience I had, fighting my way through the system, dealing with, you know, executive ego, trying to get my point across, trying to people to think about the team first, and those type of things. So we thought it would be a great idea to get John on the podcast, and we could talk about that.
I'd like to introduce John, because no one knows who John is.
Mm-hmm.
So hi, John. How are you?
I'm fantastic. It's hard not to be down here in Costa Rica. Another terrible day.
Well, we're going to a balmy 15 here in Calgary, so people will be out in their shorts. So can you give us a quick background on yourself so you know who you are?
So I've worked in the electricity utilities industry for 39 years in my first career. Currently on my second career now for the last couple of years with a more of a consulting services company that supports utilities. I've been a nuclear operator. I've been in a little bit in transmission and mostly in the distribution side of the utilities, all in Ontario. Okay. Basically, was hired right out of grade 13 to go into the old Ontario Hydro nuclear training program.
And
which was...
I noticed a little glow about you.
Yeah. more stamina, though.
Didn't want to mention that little halo around him I'm seeing.
That was really exciting. So they basically pulled you out of grade 13, and they were looking for maths and sciences, and you know, Rick would never have made it.
I agree.
Looking for those that were strong in the maths and sciences, and basically put them into school. And you come out of it with a combined training and in-station experience over a couple of years, and you come out of that as an assistant nuclear operator. Which, being young, I'm going, this is really cool technology. And we're pumping out a lot of power here. And within that realm, there is opportunities to move up the food chain.
Okay.
But I seem to be hitting the glass ceiling. And
just to go back to that, so you basically started from the ground up.
Very much so.
Yeah, and I think that's what I think that as we've talked, that's what's driven those similarities. Because as we were talking earlier, I mean, I was limited by certain things I could not and couldn't do. And that pushed me down a certain road. that you're right. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do the sciences. I couldn't do the math. I couldn't do those things. So it came to people and delegation. And I became very good at that because my limitations already pushed me there. And on the other side of the people we talk is a typical executive, you know, very smart, get all the degrees, become very good talkers, political acumen's great, they're very high IQ. And they learn a certain set of skills based on that, which are very different from mine. And John, I almost put you in that middle. You're in between us. You're not neurodiverse, but you've taken the time to go and work at ground level. And when you worked at ground level, you learned things that other people at an executive level just can't. I mean, if you know what I mean?
Yeah. Absolutely, Rick. You know, especially on this journey, this leadership journey over 39 years, and moving from the trenches to the VP level, which is where I eventually finished in the utilities as vice president of operations, five different departments reporting to me. And how many staff? That would have been probably close to 200 staff out of a utility of 1,500.
Wow.
Mm. But it was
That's
good.
A lot of
it was basically technology focused departments. I can't even describe them because they wouldn't make a lot of sense to your listeners, but very technical, very, you know, communications, instrumentation, metering would be some of that, substation technicians, the control room, emergency management.
Wow.
And the problem that I had, as Rick has been kind of describing, is that I had to get into the weeds to completely understand each of those areas in order to lead them. And so when you're working side by side with some of your staff, mm-hmm. they'll talk to, you know, if I had this tool or if we did this a better way, I could get this done in half the time, or I could do a much better job, be way more efficient. So it's those little nuggets that you pick up when you were in the weeds.
But also you had the enough humility to listen.
Absolutely.
And you learned that from being in the weeds over and over and again, right?
Listening and seeing. And establishing those relationships with them, much like you describe in your book with a lot of your staff. Hey, you're married, you have kids, what's going on? You're playing hockey, taking the kids to hockey. So you establish those relationships, and now their work effort is they're now holding, hey, if I know John now, I know the vice president, I can't screw this up because
100%,
John's going to call me out on it. So that was... That was, I think, my secret sauce, which is somewhat similar to yours. A couple of things, getting in the weeds, getting to know the staff, even working side by side, which in a unionized environment is really a no-no for management, but I couldn't help myself.
Oh, I'm sure.
So you also mentioned about, so that's you, and that's the way you deal with things, but you're dealing with executives sitting across the table or around the table with you who see the world much different than you, have got big egos, have not really had to learn humility. So how did you deal with all that?
Yeah, so that's very interesting. So I could be out at a substation or out in the field in the morning, covered, wearing my oranges, covered in grease, goo, and in the boardroom in the afternoon.
Wow.
And have to shower, and I still got dirt under my fingernails. And so instead of being that frontline leadership, now you're at the C-level kind of leadership discussions. And generally, the people in the room that are in there have not been out to the field, have not experienced, and they're just speaking from their lofty perch on how we should do things.
Theoretical, basically.
Right. Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've sometimes I stick my foot in my mouth and there'll be a whole bunch of people around the boardroom table talking away about spending millions and millions and millions or doing this and doing that and bring in more consultants. And I kind of wait to be a pause in the conversation. I said, well, you know what I think? I think we need a few more plumbers out there and we can get this done.
Yeah. It must raise a few eyebrows.
It did. Yeah.
You know, with your dirty fingernails. Oh, my God.
Yeah, keep those under the table.
No, but it really goes to show that your environment, your exposure, the way you approach things, you learn skills.
Absolutely.
And it's so funny because all those other people around the boardroom table have learned their own set of skills. And they look at you and you say things going, John doesn't get it. You know, and you look at them and you say they don't get it. And there's that dilemma between the two based on different worlds lived, different experience lived, right?
The knack that I had was taking very technical details from the field, bringing them to the sea level and putting them in layman's terms so that they can understand. Here's why this will work. Here's why that won't work. Here's where we should go forward. And it was that ability. I've had that ability my entire life is to take complex technical issues in my business and put them in the layman's terms.
Dumb them down.
Dumb them down, yes, very much.
Oh, yeah, dumb them down. I'm good at that.
I'm not saying nothing.
That, yeah, sorry, to do that, you had to be in the trenches and see it, experience it, and feel it.
We use the term battlefield commander. And yeah. I thought, isn't that just appropriate? Then it really gives you the sense that theory's out the window. It's all about practicality, dealing with the real, real issues on the ground, and moving and motivating your team in a fashion that gets them to the end goal.
Yes, absolutely.
No theory.
You feel their pain when they're out there working on something, so you can feel your pain. You feel where they're getting frustrated. And as I mentioned before, if I had that tool or if I had another person to help me with something, we could get it done better, quicker, get more performance out of a piece of equipment.
Right. So when you got to the VP level, did you implement a lot of that stuff? Did you have to wait till you got up there, or could you do it as you went through the ranks?
So it was a journey the whole way. I would say about halfway through my career, started with a couple of others on the leadership discussion. What makes a leader? I also mentioned to Rick that they started a program about 20 years ago that I got enrolled in through my utility. It was put on by the Schulich School of Business. And it was called the Master's Program in Energy Leadership. And it was 1 to 2 week sessions, 4 or 5 times a year. And a number of either existing leaders, so there was presidents in my class and VPs, but also up and comers. So I was a manager at that time when I was enrolled in it. And it went through a year and a half. And you get together every couple of months at York University, and you go through new leadership training. You get analyzed. You do role playing. All those sorts of things. So it was quite interesting. So I learned a lot about the science of leadership, but not everybody's a leader.
No, and that's the thing. That's interesting. You took this with other CEOs and stuff. Oh. And I'm sure you could see that some people are getting it and some people aren't.
And some people are faking that they're getting it.
The smart ones. Yeah.
Well, you got to fake it till you get it, or until you make it, right?
And some thought they knew it all already. Which was quite interesting to observe. I'm like a sponge. I'm just soaking it all up and learning everything. And I do like to learn continually. I think learning is a lifelong passion of mine. But others were like, why are you here?
Well, John, I'm a firm believer that the great number one quality to be a strong leader is humility. And you know what? You have to fail. You have to be willing to fail and take risk. And it's that failure time after time and being open to other people's opinion on your failure, which doesn't happen to people at a certain level or at a certain, like those, the typical executives highly, they really don't want that because, you know, that diminishes their worth. Me, on the other hand, I think it makes me of greater worth. I'm learning. I realize I don't know shit. I just know it.
I have failed in life in a couple of events that made me stronger. I've learned from them. You have to be prepared to fail. And you and I have both talked about that. And I've had a couple of significant failures in my life. I actually, one time I was in college for flight school. And they had limited funding, so they take on 24. They drop 6 a term. I was the first one cut. I thought I was doing great.
Oh.
I was supposed to be a commercial pilot. I was out within 6 months. I came up with a private pilot's license. But, oh, was I ever embarrassed about that? Having to go home with my
I've had the same thing. It was around getting certified for National Lifeguard, which I had done many times, but I got fat and out at the bars, and they saw me out at the bars, and they failed my ass. And it just was like, oh, my God, where can I hide? But does that teach you a thing or two, let me tell you?
And, you know, reflecting on leadership, we talked about a couple of the early events of my life working at McDonald's as a teenager. And becoming a swing supervisor as a teenager, supervising other kids working at McDonald's. And some of the basic leadership things that McDonald's was teaching, this is going back 45, 50 years ago. Rick, you grab a broom, I'll grab a mop. Let's go clean that up. That was, you know, a little nugget that I learned way back when. But that kind of puts you back in the trenches when you think about later on.
Rick was saying that you read the book. And that you had picked a few things out of the book that really resonated with you. And I was just wondering if we could hear what those ones were.
Yeah, so key, and we've just talked about it, was fear of failure.
Okay.
You take on something new, you're assigned something new, And, oh my God, I better get this right or I'm in trouble. So it was that fear of failure. But I also went through a period, which as I read it in Rick's book, he did too, that, you know what, I'm actually pretty good at what I was doing. And I moved from fear of failure to, give me that project. We're going to win this one.
And, right on, yeah.
Yeah, so, but it took a long time and a number of failures to realize that. And reading your book, you came to the same conclusion.
Yeah, with some help, actually. It took me some help to see the difference, you know, to reset the brain that way. And another one you mentioned, and Judy, you'll love this, is done is better than perfect.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know what? That little phrase, I use it now because I was just saying, let's get it done because certain projects you can delay, you'll have scope creep. And I'm going, get it done in production and we can circle back at a later date and do the enhancements that you'll go forever and ever and never actually get it in place if you try and get it perfect the first time.
Yes.
So yeah, we take that approach now.
Yeah, if you know what, they would save a ton of companies and a ton of managers a ton of time if they would just encompass that one thing. Just stop fucking talking about it and do something.
Exactly.
And just beat it to death.
Yeah, Rick, you talked about utilities are so risk averse. Oh, my God, they're butt puckers up when they're thinking about risk.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Stay between the lanes. Don't drift. Don't change unless we absolutely have to. They're licensed monopolies. What impetus is there to change other than if the regulator tells you to change?
Right.
So keep your budget. Make sure you spend the money in that budget because if you don't spend it, you're going to lose it next year.
Yeah.
But very risk averse.
But the risk is it depends how you define risk because the risk in that situation is looking like I failed. Looking like I tried to accomplish it and didn't accomplish it, and they're looking bad in front of the boss's eyes.
Very much so.
You know what I mean? And that's a focus on getting ahead in my career. And I, of course, we all have that a little bit. But my focus was more of, I mean, I couldn't work with my team and just shovel shit. I had to be honest and truthful because I just couldn't do it another way.
Yeah. And part of the, you know, I told you that I've only really applied in the utilities twice for any of the roles that I've had. One was the initial position that I got into that nuclear training program. And then at the very end, on the latest merger to be VP of the new big utility, I actually had to apply for that and sit with the four presidents of that merger in a room for a position. Between that and the end, I never applied for a role. It just getting dumped onto me. Oh, we're going to make you a supervisor, or we're going to make you a manager, and here's some more responsibility. Oh, we're going to make you a senior manager. Here's some more responsibility. Oh, we'll make you a director. Oh, we're going to make you a senior. It just more and more, and bring it on.
Well, that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's fabulous.
So if you're going to give advice to young executives, your managers trying to get up the industry, I mean, what would it be? I mean, obviously, I think that understanding the roots of the business is critical. Not just understanding it, but getting in and feeling it and touching it and talking with people and really getting a sense to what other people, what's impacting them, I think would be one I would see that you've said already, but not to put those words in your mouth. But
yeah, get out of the office, get into the field, talk to your staff out in the field. And I'm actually rewinding, you know, what you were talking about, the battlefield commander thing. And I'm reminded of the tanks that were given during World War II. The first thing that the crews did was rip the governors off so they could go faster. And, you know, there's your feedback from the field, how you can do things better.
Yeah, I don't think I want to. I think I'd rather be in the fast tank than the slow tank. Exactly. No kidding. Jesus Christ. Yeah.
No kidding. But, yeah.
Well, that was a little lesson.
But what about in this world where everybody works remotely in that? How do you, and I, that was part of the conversation I had when I was on that interview yesterday, was how do we, if relationships are so important, if getting out in the field is so important, how do you do that now when everyone works remote?
Great question. So in joining my new company for the last couple of years, which is, as I mentioned, a consulting, providing services to utilities, leveraging my experience and the rest of our great team, one of the first things that I did when I joined this new company is they're holding their Zoom meetings, their Microsoft Team meetings with the cameras off. And I'm brand new. And I go, I want to see you. Who are you? I want to see the body language. And so first I got to know them virtually. And then as I assembled my team, we are going in on Wednesdays to the office we're having anchor days, as I called them. So that was my little team.
When they come in Wednesday, are you rethinking what they do? Because you don't want to fill Wednesday with meeting after meeting after meeting, because then you notify the how do you learn develop a relationship? So I think you got to reorganize what Wednesday is going to be, too.
Absolutely.
Right?
It's almost a social day.
Yeah.
So we go in, we can. You need that face-to-face, like that view. You see the body language.
Oh, yeah.
Are you struggling? Oh, I'm doing okay. Well, your body language is telling me different. And it's the personal interactions that you get. So having said that, so my team has been going in now for Wednesdays. The rest of the company is starting to adopt this. And even though we have a pretty liberal policy that you can work virtually, you don't have to go in the office, but it all seems to be coming back, not from a work requirement basis, but for that human interaction with each other.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if people say, I don't want to work remote. I enjoy going to the office and my team so much that I want to go to the office more. Yeah. And I'm interested in the body language, because I think that's a critical piece. And I think that all good leaders read body language. And there's a sensitivity to that. You have to be looking. You can't be so self-absorbed with yourself that you're worried about me. You've got to be looking at the other people. And if you're looking, man, you can see it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's in the eyes. It's in the shuffling of the chair. And then I was always bold enough to say, hey, you over there in the corner, I can tell you think I'm full of shit. You want to speak up?
Yeah. So that, I mean, again, these are little nuggets in the leadership journey that you apply and drawn from my past experience of, we talked about working with some tough nuts in some of the departments I had. There was the troublemaker, the noisemaker, and I'd inherit a new department. So I have to, okay, who's causing grief in that department? Who's the tough nut, the leader of the pack, if you will? And always for some reason, being a utility, oh, they're big men, right? Always be the biggest guy that was the tough nut. So I made a point whenever we were going through another merger, and I'm taking on more staff, who is the tough nut in that crowd? Talk to the supervisor. Oh, you got to go speak to Tony. So I go up to Tony, and he's the first one in that new department that I've absorbed that I make a relationship with. Hey, you're married. How's the kids? Blah, blah, blah. My name's John. I've got a couple of kids. They're in hockey, so on and so forth. And I'd work so hard to develop that relationship. So, and then the beauty of that is now he's beholden to me in all his work performance. He's not bad-mouthing the company. He gets a project to do. Taking pride, man, John's going to be here tomorrow to see this, to see what my job is. And it worked time after time again. Go after the tough nut.
But you made a good point, though. It wasn't just go and talk to the tough nut. You worked hard at it. Because if you think you walk in, you talk to the tough nut, and tomorrow he loves you, that ain't the way it works. It takes work. You got to go back and back and back again, because it's over a little bit of a period of time that they go, I guess John's not so bad.
Yeah. And you know what's even funnier is, so before the pandemic, you're sitting in your office with the other VPs, a senior level, and here comes a guy in orange, all grimy, coming up to see you. And the rest of the executives are going, who's this coming down? There's nobody in orange that comes down the hall here. We're all in suits. And he's coming in to talk to me, to tell me about a problem, or telling me how well he did.
Well, that's got to be a badge of honor. No, seriously. Really,
absolutely.
May I interrupt for a minute?
Yeah.
And just ask a question. How did the other executives react to you?
Oh, they're getting mud on the carpet.
Honest to God. Honest to God.
No, yeah. You'd see them peering around their doors, and this would, time after time, I'd have somebody coming in.
Putting their purse in their drawer.
Just to chat. Or the other thing, too, is that tough now is starting to tell me about others in the department that aren't, picking up their part of the job and pulling their weight and that kind of thing. So it worked beautifully. And that's a piece of advice that I would have to hand off to anybody.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. Wow.
When you were sitting in the meetings, and you would pipe up, would they listen to you and acknowledge what you had to say?
Great question. It depends on the crowd in the meeting at that particular moment, because I'm pretty straight to the point. And I try not to soften anything. I was like, we need to do it this way, because if we don't, we're going to waste money. It's not going to get done. It's a safety issue. And then they'll ask you questions. Why do you know that? Because I've been out there to see it.
Right.
That type of thing. So.
Right.
Other times.
Yeah, but you must have got people saying, yeah, but it's not in the budget, or that's not our policy, or,
yeah,
you know.
Right.
Like, so, they're going to push back on you.
So there was no one consistent strategy. You play the room.
You bob and weave.
Yeah, absolutely.
But that's what you've learned again from being in the field and taking risk and doing those things, that when you're always conservative, you just don't learn to bob and weave.
No, you're just playing the game at a singular level.
At a singular level, yes. That's a very good way to put it, at a singular level, as when you understand the people, when you're trying to build a relationship, you're really managing at multiple levels. That's a great way to put that. Yeah. Can I steal that?
Absolutely.
Okay, cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it kind of reminds me, too, when now talking about this, is I moved a person from the trades. He was a foreman into a supervisor role. A very senior guy. Well-educated. He was at the age and the point in his career where he was actually supervising from the ranks. And I said, Doug, I said, we've got a supervisor position open. I said, you're already supervising. Do you not realize what you're doing? You're supervising everybody around you. Why don't you move up in that role, get off shift work, and get paid more for it as you're entering the last few years before your retirement? He's going, oh, so he was worried about stepping away from the crowd.
Yeah.
And you know, now standing in the limelight, be expected to lead. And so I actually convinced him to do it. I think I took a few extra dollars in his salary to convince him to move into the supervisor role. And he excelled at it.
But
and
the one thing I've seen in the past, it wasn't the worrying so much as stepping out of that crowd. It was I was stepping into another crowd.
That is very
And true. I don't know if I really like that other crowd, because I know that's more politics and backstabbing and stuff like that. And that's the worry. Can I survive that crowd?
It's a good point. And part of my job would be to shield them a little bit.
Absolutely.
But an interesting point. After a while as a supervisor, he's going, wow, he said, this is actually unique and tough at the same time. And I said, well, what do you mean? He says, well, it's tough because I've got these older staff that have been in the ranks, in the trade ranks for years, and they take one style of supervision. And I've got the Gen X and Gen Ys. They don't want to work overtime. They want more time off.
Right.
And I said, I've got to apply different tactics to effectively supervise and get each of those groups.
Right.
So it was a really good observation. And
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because
there's such a difference in the way they want to work. So did when you took him to the supervisor level, did he stay though going on the floor, well, going wherever it was and dealing with, you know, being part of the group still?
He did very well. He basically did exactly what he was doing before, except he's got his own office and
he's getting paid. He's
getting paid. He's off shift work and salary's bumped up going for his retirement.
Yeah.
Worked out very well.
Well, okay. Oh, so we should wrap this up. John, it was awesome to have you on. And it was a different perspective because we have talked, like, if you're not neurodiverse, what are we going to talk about? And we found this lane that I think is, now that we've found it, I think it's critical, is that I was forced one way and the typical executives are forced another because that's what they want to do. But there's that middle ground. That middle ground of a typical, I would call you very typical as far as it comes to education and IQ and all that sort of stuff, but entered into the real world, got into the ground level, took the time to understand, to develop sensitivity, humility, you know, changed your perspective, and that allowed you to manage very, very differently.
It did. And one thing we haven't talked about, but I do want to bring up, I also recognize that going right from high school into the industry, what did I lack?
Right.
Support me moving up. So went to school part-time for 15, 20 years, first getting a college diploma and then getting a Bachelor of Applied Science degree.
Yeah, that is so true, isn't it? I mean, and we've talked about it on the podcast before. I have a couple of digits behind my name too, but I cheated to get them all. But it made a difference.
My
knowledge changed zero based on those.
Yeah, we've talked about that a lot. I'll tell you from my point of view, sitting here listening to you two talk, you're very similar in a lot of ways. It's like you both kind of found, you're neurodiverse, you're typical, but you both found that middle road that's different and works for both of you in your own ways, but you're very similar.
No,
it's
interesting. I would agree with that too. And just the thing that I would shout out to the atypical neurodiverse that are listening is that you get told a lot of times that those limitations that you have are killers. Mm-hmm. The growth killers, mm-hmm. You never get promoted knowing that. That's just a crock of shit. I think you got to bottle what's positive, take it to town, work with it, develop skills from that, and that will drive your success.
Yeah,
right.
I agree.
Right.
For sure. Yeah. Everything is a lesson.
Somewhere definitely. The corporate world's got to evolve. Even testing is still, I care all the guards with testing. Oh, yeah, we figured that out. That's all calculated in the testing. Yeah, bullshit. That we need, corporate world needs to look like, frankly, for people like you who understand the bones of leadership, how to drive things, how to simplify, how to, the whole concept of done is better than perfect. People that are so centered on themselves, so centered in impressing other executives, and that really drives their success, which does nothing for the team. And sure, they can accomplish getting to the budget, but you know what me and you, John, can do? Sometimes we can accomplish the impossible because we've got a crowd of people with us. Going with us and if you've got 100 motivated people running in the same direction, it's crazy what you can accomplish.
Absolutely. And the other thing too, right, is that at the senior level, you're actually going to identify who's with you, who's kind of who your allies are and your support group and get it as opposed to just the back office wankers.
Yeah,
I can use that term.
Wankers?
Wanker.
It's a good word, wankers.
You can use any term you want, really.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but Rick, just, it's hard these days. I mean, I came up that way. It's hard to get into a company to start at the bottom and work your way up unless you have those digits behind your name, even at an entry level sometimes.
No doubt.
It's just not as common. It's not as common as it was when we were younger. Yeah.
No, I don't think it was. I mean, might be not as common, but it was certainly my reality as I moved up. You had to have those things. And hopefully that's going to change. And not that I put anything against having the digits, because I think that's all great. I'm a big fan of university and all that sort of stuff. But it can't be the sole determination if this person is the right type of leader. It's just another consideration.
Right. Correct.
Right.
I agree.
Yeah.
But, minimum requirements. You need to have a couple of digits after your name.
Yeah, well, that's the craziness of it, right?
Yeah.
Well, it really is.
But wow.
Anyway, so
that was a fun talk.
That was a good one.
Well, thank you very much, John. It's a pleasure having you.
Thank you, John.
This has been a lot of fun.
I hope to see you when I'm down there.
I hope so, too.
It's good. Yeah.
Okay, bye.
That's it.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today and listening to another episode of The Atypical Leader. If you haven't already done so, like, share, and follow me on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, and wherever you find your favorite podcasts. By liking and sharing, you will help other atypicals find all of us, so we can all start to leverage the stories, strategies, and strengths of what make us all unique. Keep listening and remember, take charge and push away those self-doubts. Leverage what we're talking about. Be confident in who you are and proud of what makes you unique.
So join me, Rick Brennan, and my co-host Judy Sims on the next episode of The Atypical Leader. And don't forget to get your copy of the book, The Atypical Leader, Harnessing the Power of Neurodiversity on Amazon. To learn more about us, leadership, and neurodiversity, please go to our website, atypicalleader.com.
Thanks for listening. Let's do it again next week.